Take a base of action. Green group, steer across the holding sector of each other.
Admiral, we have enemy ships in Sector 47.
It's a trap!
A couple of weeks ago, I bought a ringrib, which seems like a fairly substantial part of a cow.
Right, but you wouldn't be able to put it back into a cow at some point. Like, you wouldn't be able to reassemble it into a cow. Hello, welcome to Paper Round. My name is Matt Collin. I'm a David M. Rubenstein Fellow in the Global Economy and Development Program at the Brookings Institution.
And I'm Ronald Snack. I'm a Policy Fellow at the Center for Global Development.
So, Randall and I have known each other for a very, very long time. We met over a decade ago in Malawi when we were both working for the Ministry of Finance in Lilongwe.
More like 20 years.
And those are 20 years, 10 to 20 years I can't get back. But since we're stuck in it together, Randall and I have been thinking about development for a long time. We founded a blog together named Aid Thoughts, in which we could write down all the things that intrigued us, all the questions that we had, and all the takes that we had on development issues. But recently, blogging is no longer in favor. Why is that, Randall?
Most buckets are boring. And people's attention span has been sort of decimated by Twitter. I joined Twitter last year, like, partly because I was joining CGD, and I could, you know, say what I think in public without being fired, because I used to be a civil servant. It is a massive time sink, but the thing is that it doesn't actually translate into that much greater productivity. Maybe a bit more reading, but most of the time, actually, all I'm looking at, watching, reading is people shitposting about somebody they don't like.
Twitter's been a great forum for new research about getting it out, but it's a hard place to discuss research in any great depth, because it's only a matter of time before someone who has really strong feelings about that research will show up and make their feelings known, which...
And someone compares you to Hitler. Let's put it this way. It's quite nice on Twitter when somebody puts up a new paper and does a really good thread on it, right? I think Michael Clemens is great at that. Every time he does a new note, there's this really clear thread. I have no idea how long it takes him to write them. In my brain, he's just sort of jotting them down. And that's awesome, right? You know, I can imagine you can read one of his papers, if you're willing to trust that his methods are impeccable, which they always are, and just sort of like, just read the thread instead. But then you get a bunch of other stuff where, like, people pick one sentence from an abstract, put it on Twitter, and it's like, look, when you invest in this, you get, you know, 324% returns. Or, you know, it's like, hey, everybody, Angus Deaton doesn't believe in evidence.
Randall, that's exactly what I did about 5 minutes before we started recording this podcast, is I posted an abstract of a paper and said, great, hey, look how great these effects are. And probably by the time we signed back onto Twitter, someone will have pointed out what I got wrong about that.
Anyway, what we're trying to do here is we both basically thought that recently our day jobs have been kind of all-consuming. And one of the things we could do with that time that we're saving... not commuting to the office every day, is to actually read something in depth and put our thoughts together in some sort of coherence and then talk about it. The original plan was that we would do this over a bottle of wine, but I want to remember what we talked about, and I've just had a tiny baby, so, you know, like, one glass of wine is enough to put me down for the count.
Our aim for the podcast is to pick typically a new paper in the area of development economics, or sometimes in economics more broadly, one that we think is important, that we think has something to say that's relevant for our area of interest. We both read it in great detail, and we're gonna talk about it. The paper we've chosen for this episode is Why Do Poor People Stay Poor? Evidence on Poverty Traps from Rural Bangladesh. This has many, many authors, Randall.
Yeah, many, 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 like, really, really good authors. So it's kind of intimidating to discuss this in public.
So this is by six different authors. It's by Claire Balboni, Orianda Bandiera, Robin Burgess, Matrish Ghatak, and Anton Heil. And this is a paper, mistake me if I'm wrong, Randall, this is a paper that's been floating around for a couple of years now, right? The latest version, the one that we've looked at for this podcast, came out just a few weeks ago. It first made splashes a year or two ago, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, I think I saw Orianda Bandiera present this paper about 2 years ago at what was then DFID.
So this paper is about something called poverty traps. It's something that many of us learned in graduate school and occasionally have encountered since then. But the idea that potentially poor people can stay stuck in poverty, but what do you see the poverty trap as being? How would you best explain it, Ronald?
Basically, you could dumb this down into basically saying there are just two reasons why you might be poor. You could basically be poor because somehow there's something wrong with you. You're not putting in enough effort, you're not talented enough, or whatever, right? And the analogy I like to use on this, or I've liked to use since I saw the movie, is... Have you seen The Dark Knight Rises? I know you have, right? You've seen The Dark Knight Rises.
I've seen The Dark Knight Rises many a time, yeah.
I was gonna do this section in Bane's voice, but I'm not confident enough to do it on our first run through of the podcast.
Let's not stand on ceremony here, Mr. Wayne.
So there's this bit in The Dark Knight Rises where Bruce Wayne gets thrown into the pit. And the pit is basically this place where there are these, it's a deep, deep, deep hole. And theoretically, you could scale up the walls, right? Like, sort of pull yourself up by your fingertips and sort of climb out of the pit. And so the first theory of why people are poor is that they're just not tough enough to climb out of the pit. And tough can mean whatever you want. Talented or, you know, hardworking or whatever. And the theory is basically like, if you're a little bit more like Batman, you would get out of poverty. So you can bootstrap yourself up.
Despite the fact that Bane's broken your back, you can, if you're just a little bit tougher, if you had a little bit more willpower, you might be able to claw your way out of the pit.
Right, yeah, walk it off. That's sort of theory one. And theory two is something different, which is basically like, there's something wrong with the game. Imagine you're playing Super Mario, and you need to jump from one level to another. When Mario is little, he can't make the jump. You gotta eat one of those mushrooms, and then he gets bigger, and he can jump much higher, and then he can jump to the next level, right? And so the second theory is basically like, without the mushroom, it's just not possible to make the jump. The poverty trap's idea is that there are some people who just don't have the mushroom, so they will never be able to make that jump without some sort of help. It's sort of, I think, important to note, as the paper does, that the two views are not wholly exclusive. There may be some individuals for whom the trap is not salient, and there may be some individuals for whom, even if they get the mushroom, they can't make the jump, right? That's possible at an individual level. The argument that sort of development economists have been having for years is whether most poverty is more like you're not Batman enough, or most poverty is more like you haven't had the mushroom.
Is the idea, though, that some people are stuck in a poverty trap that surprising on the face of it, though? In the sense that we know that if people can successfully migrate from a low-income country to a richer country, the same people with the same skills, you know, the same background, the same abilities, the same level of gusto can go and earn a lot of money and earn enough money to escape poverty in other locations. Is this a very specific way of thinking about poverty? Maybe we'll get into it when we talk about the paper, but is this a very specific type of poverty trap that we're looking at? These are very, very poor people in typically very rural settings, earning enough income to escape what we'd call extreme poverty.
That's exactly why, right? I suppose the other way of thinking about this is that, like, is this typical thing that you get in the media when they're talking about welfare and support for the poorest, which is, you know, but look at this guy, he was a self-made man or woman, and they managed to bootstrap themselves up. Why can't everybody else? You know, the sort of Daily Mail view of poverty. There's some people for whom it's a genuine surprise. That, whoa, conditions make it really near impossible for this person to escape poverty. But I think for most people who are already working in development, you sort of internalized a little bit that there are going to be many, many people in situations that are just too difficult to reasonably expect them within a lifetime to call out themselves.
Yeah, people tend to focus, to go back to the example of Dark Knight Rises, where Bruce Wayne climbs out of the pit. People tend to focus on how successful people can climb out of the pit, but they ignore the fact that what happens in the very next scene is he throws a rope down and everyone else gets to escape poverty as well. Okay, so we've been discussing poverty traps in terms of Batman, in terms of Mario, but let's dig into the actual paper, which actually looks at a real setting in which people live largely in poverty, and that's of rural Bangladesh. So the paper in question relies on a randomized controlled trial which transferred assets to people living in villages in rural Bangladesh. And it's part of a number of experiments which have looked at what happens to people's lives when you give them productive assets. And in this case, it's often assets that you might use, things like cows, things like other types of cattle or animals that can be used to make more money. This is looking at, this paper, Randall looks at people living in poverty in rural Bangladesh. A, how does the paper know these people are in a poverty trap? And B, how do they go about testing it?
Can I not answer your question to begin with? Can I start by just saying like something about like the setting and something about BRAC briefly?
Yeah, of course. What's BRAC?
They've gone to, like Matt said, rural Bangladesh, right? But it's just important to impress on you just how poor the people that they're covering are, right? I mean, the program that they're investigating is called Targeting the Ultra Poor, right? And when you hear, like, economists are almost inured to the idea of extreme poverty, right? We look at the $1.90 poverty numbers every day, and it's, you know, you start to sort of like start to glaze over your eyes, right? When they're talking about the ultra poor, you're talking about really, 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 really poor people. So this study is basically in a bit of Bangladesh in really rural areas where the areas are really poor, and they're targeting the poorest people in poor areas, right? So that's the first thing to sort of like set out, right? There's something kind of special about how poor the people they're studying is. And then the second thing is that like the program that they're investigating is this Targeting the Ultra Poor program, and it's run by this organization called BRAC. And BRAC were created in, like, BRAC was founded in like the 1970s, I think, and it is the best NGO in the world, basically. Like, BRAC is, there are loads of papers investigating BRAC-run programs. And BRAC is brilliant, partly because it actively encourages working with all these researchers to learn about how it's doing and to tweak its methods and so on. But it does that also because it is a brilliantly run organization, right? So when you see a paper, and there are loads of papers that BRAC does stuff on, like empowering adolescent girls, it does surveys on disease and nutrition, and it does the Targeting the Ultra Poor thing. And when you see a paper and it says, like, we partnered with BRAC, the kind of, like, the thing that should be going in your head is, like, this is probably, you're looking at the best possibly implemented version of the intervention that they're doing, right? Because BRAC are really, really, really good. And what they do with this specific intervention, and the intervention is basically, it's a cow and some training. They give people a cow, which is a big deal. Like, remember when I said these are the poorest of the poor people in Bangladesh? Getting a cow is a big deal. It's a big asset. And for the poorest, it is many, many multiples of the existing assets that they already have. And so they basically give people a cow. And the study relies on the fact that they... So two things it relies on. One is that they randomly assign in some villages the cow to the sort of like poorest 10% of the population in those villages, and they don't in other villages, which gives them something to compare about. But the other thing that the study really hinges on, which is not random, is that they are giving the cow to a wide enough section of the population such that some of those people are relatively poorer than others. And it's that they leverage into sort of investigating whether or not a poverty trap exists.
But just to circle back briefly on how poor these people are, I was just looking up the summary statistics from the paper. And BRAC, if I'm not mistaken, targets women in ultra-poor households. But those that are labeled ultra-poor, we're talking about people that have half a year of formal education. An average body mass index of 18, which is very close, I believe, to actually being underweight. And that's the average. And an hourly income of 4.6, just under 5. What is BDT? What's the Bangladesh currency?
Taka.
Let's just say they have very low levels of income. They're ultra poor, but not for want of working. Most of these women are, about 84% of these women are actively involved in the labor force. These are people that are working, but are still poor and not eating very much.
Yeah, and that's a really good point, because a lot of what the paper argues is essentially that the poverty trap is not about how much you can work. It's about what work you can do. It's basically arguing that there is massive misallocation of people to the kind of work that they could most productively do in that context. And that misallocation is driven by sort of their level of assets, and that's the trap, basically.
Okay, so we have this experiment where the intervention is this asset bundle. I think it's mainly a cow. I think people have some choice over what they can get. It's about $500 worth of a transfer, right? And there is the authors of the paper write down a model to try and get a sense of how you might see if there was a poverty trap in how much in assets a household earns. And there's different ways you can think about it. One is one in which your assets grow. It's a function of how much you save. It's a function of how hard you work. And, you know, your assets today just grow as you save more. And eventually you hit a point, a steady state point, where your assets stop growing. And if you have a low level of assets and a low level of income, it's, you know, as we said before, it's because you're not working hard enough, or perhaps there are other factors, but there's no inherent poverty trap in the amount of wealth that you have. But then the authors point out an alternative world in which there is an S-shaped relationship between the assets that you have today and those that you have tomorrow. And at very low levels of assets, if you don't have enough assets, then they start depleting, and you return to kind of an equilibrium where you don't have much in terms of wealth, in terms of assets, and you don't make much income, and you can't grow them. If you try and grow them, they just deplete backwards, a bit like your Bruce Wayne falling back into the pit. But there's in this S-shaped world, there's an inflection point where if you can grow your assets enough and you can obtain maybe more productive assets, then they start growing and they feed into each other. So you have more assets next year than you did the year before, and you reach a higher steady state. This is the equivalent of Bruce Wayne climbing up out of the pit and making his way onto the plane above it. And a lot of this paper is trying to understand, just looking at the data, which of these two realities is more likely. And it's very difficult to do that when you're just looking at poor people, because they might all be stuck in the pit. They might all just have low levels of assets that aren't growing. And what in the paper, when they look at people's assets, they find that there's this massive bimodal distribution. There's a lot of people that have a lot of assets, and there's a lot of people that don't have very much. And so they posit that this might be because a lot of people have fallen back into this lower level equilibrium, where others have managed to accumulate more and more and more and reach a relatively not wealthy, but just, you know, a better life than the rest. So as you said, you know, they everyone got the same amount of money. Everyone got $500 worth of assets. So everyone got the same push out of the pit. But as you noted before, there are different levels of starting assets. So some people had a little bit of wealth and some people had not very much. And so there's a little bit of a difference in how much wealth you had after you got this massive transfer. And what they basically do is they basically just see if there's a relationship between the amount of wealth you have the minute you get the cow and how much wealth you have 1 year, 2 years, 5 years down the road. And I believe that the latest version of the paper is 10 years, although I'm not sure if the wealth results are go that far.
11 years, yeah.
11 years, wow.
Can you imagine being able just to follow up the same people for 11 years? That would test my patience. They would be tired of me.
And what they find is that after you got that transfer, if you had just over, I think it's just over $500 worth of assets in total, so your existing wealth plus the transfer, you saw your wealth grow. Your wealth got greater and greater the next year. It started accelerating. But those that didn't quite hit that threshold, their wealth started falling back. They started falling back into poverty. And there's a great picture, we'll put it on our website, of this S-shaped curve, which seems to be describing what is an asset-based poverty trap. And that, you know, that's kind of the whole, you know, we've been talking about poverty traps in development econ for a long time, but this is kind of the holy grail image, right? This is the first time someone's actually shown the S-shaped curve in a pretty demonstrable kind of way. What did you think when you first saw that curve?
Oh man, I mean, it's like I've been reading to my son Mr. Archimedes' Bath, and it's the story about Archimedes getting into the bath with all of his friends. They're all barnyard animals, Australian animals, and how he sort of keeps coming out and, like, getting in the bath and getting out of the bath and measuring the water until he realizes that it's his presence in the water that's causing his bathtub to overflow, right? And he yells out, as everyone now knows, Archimedes yells out, "Eureka!" And that's the feeling you get when you read it, right? It's pretty cool to see it, because it's one of those things where, you know, like, I don't know, like, I'm definitely not a scientist, but my understanding is that, like, physicists had thought that the Higgs boson existed because they could see all the shapes around it, but they never actually observed it until relatively recently. And that was like a big, massive sort of, I presume it's going to win the Nobel Prize, or already has. It was a big moment. It feels a little bit like that, right? And it especially feels like that because we've actually spent a bunch of money in development on the theory that poverty traps exist. Not always well, right? Like, I mean, the Millennium Village Project, that's the whole point of the Millennium Village Project, is that there is a big poverty trap, right? But the difference between what these guys have done and what the MVPs did was that the MVPs started from the assumption that we know what this poverty trap looks like. We know exactly how it functions. Therefore, we can spend on this kind of hospital, this kind of education, etc., and it will be fixed. And that proved wrong, right? So that proved that that wound up not being the case. What this paper does is it actually tries to dig down into the detail and observe, in practice, what is the specific poverty trap that exists here? And what is the specific intervention that sort of overcomes it? Now, they don't sort of narrow down into saying this is the only thing that would overcome it, but they find a specific thing that works. That's for extremely ultra-poor people, you know? And if you work in development enough, you've heard lots of people say that's the hardest poverty to overcome. It's when you're, like, not just at the extreme poverty line, but you're way, way below it, right? That's a huge deal.
And it's not to say that people that get out of ultra poverty are, you know, doing great in life, but it's a very great first step in a lot of ways. And the thing about the paper, which is incredibly fortuitous and kind of amazing that it happened, is that if the BRAC transfer had been too much, everyone would have escaped poverty, which would have been great.
Like $20 more valuable, basically.
Right. It would have been great for them. If it had been too little, everyone would have fallen back into poverty. In both of those circumstances, they wouldn't have been able to identify this S-shaped curve. It's only because the transfer was just enough to push some people over, but not other people, that it became empirically visible. So, like, you can imagine there's lots of other papers out there looking at similar types of transfers, but if they don't actually push people just over the edge, then you're not going to observe this thing in the first place.
So yeah, I want to like dig into that a little bit more, but I feel like I might be jumping ahead in our discussion.
So it's probably worth just noting two things. One is there's this S-shaped curve, which is something that they thought existed. Then there's another curve, which is rather than there being S-shaped, there just being a point where your ability to grow your assets just jumps discontinuously, just jumps a lot. And that can be because the production function is what we call indivisible, that you can basically, you either have a cow or you don't have a cow. If you have a cow, you can sell its milk, you can, you know, maybe sell its meat, you can do lots of things with it. But if you don't have a cow, you can't do any of those things. And so there's lumpiness in the capital you need to make money. And markets, I guess, are incomplete, Randall. I guess you can't buy shares in cows nowadays.
I haven't tried. Oh, well, I mean, I say that, but, you know, a couple of weeks ago, I bought a ring rib, which seems like it seemed like a fairly substantial part of a cow.
Right. But you wouldn't be able to put it back into a cow at some point. Like, you wouldn't be able to reassemble it into a cow.
Yeah, I mean, I think the damage was done to the cow by then.
But there is one concern in this. So, like, this is this nice result, but and authors say it rests on basically kind of one major assumption, and that is that there's nothing going on, there's no major differences between people before the transfer happened, between people that had a little bit of wealth and those that didn't have any wealth. And, you know, so if it's the case that people that had a little bit of wealth, you know, they had some assets, are actually superstars. They're actually just like waiting to get their hands on a cow, and they're going to do so much better than those who don't have any assets. Then that huge divergence you see in their life outcomes might just be due to these kind of inherent characteristics. I like to think of the example of Eddie Murphy's character in Trading Places. He's, at the time when the movie starts, he's this beggar, he's asking for money, but in fact, he's this really, really effective negotiator and con man. And the minute he gets the chance to swap places with Dan Aykroyd and becomes a stock trader, he flourishes very quickly. And obviously the chance to trade places, that kind of transfer he gets at the beginning of the film, plays a role in his life, but it wouldn't necessarily have transformed his life had he been no good at, had he not had those skills in the first place.
Tell me just why you think the price of pork bellies is going down, William.
Okay, pork belly prices have been dropping all morning, which means everybody's sitting in their office and they're waiting for them to hit rock bottom so they can buy cheap and go long. So people that own the pork belly contracts are going batshit. So they're thinking, hey, we're losing all our damn money, and Christmas is around the corner, and I ain't gonna have no money to buy my son the G.I. Joe with the Kung Fu grip, okay? And my wife ain't gonna make love to me because I ain't got no money, right? So they're sitting there, and they're panicking, they're screaming, sell, sell!
Yeah, I mean, yeah, exactly right. Eddie Murphy can talk you into stuff, right? That's not necessarily true of the next sort of homeless criminal that Randolph or Mortimer could have picked. But yeah, you know, like, I want to sort of make another point about this as well, which is there's always something unobservable, right? And it doesn't always convince me to say, like, but can you rule out that there's an unobservable difference? No one can ever do that, right? The question is more like, is it plausible that there is an unobservable difference? Is that plausible enough to make me sort of question all the rest of what I'm seeing here? And in this case, that for me, that, like, I don't think so, really. The question I've got is something slightly different, right? So the way they look at it is, like, they say the $500 transfer is a cow, and the amount of initial assets that you need, they say in the paper, is something about, like, what you would need to have, like, a plow or a shed or some complementary thing to a cow. And the way that the program works is that they give you a cow and they encourage you, like, can you keep the cow for 2 years before you sell it, at least, right? Give the cow a chance. Give cows a chance.
Yeah, give cows a chance. Give cheese a chance.
And they point out at the beginning, right, that this is a place where the labor market is really, really restricted. You can either work on somebody else's cow, or you can own a cow and do stuff with cows. More or less, right? There are just two sort of options. You can be a cow owner and you hire other people, or you don't have a cow and you work for the people who own the cows.
I mean, and cow is a shorthand because there are other farming opportunities, I assume. This is with my extensive knowledge of rural Bangladesh. I'm just trying to see in the list of assets people can have. Yeah, it is mainly cows, isn't it? Yeah.
It is mainly cows, right? You need a lot of goats to come up to $500 worth of goats. And so, like, so this is the question, right? It's totally plausible to me that given these two options, you're either a cow owner or a worker, if you don't have enough money to get a plow or a shed, then your cow basically just starts to lose a bit of weight and becomes slightly bedraggled. And in 2 years, you sell the cow off for less than it was worth at the beginning. And if you did happen to own a plow, it's totally plausible to me, or that you use the cow productively, you till your land really well, and then it's a beautiful upward virtuous circle. So that's the definition of what a poverty trap is, basically, right? And so that's very plausible to me. The question is this poverty trap picked up because of the production function for cows and the limitations of the labor market that they're looking at, right? So is it something specific about the fact that it's a cow that you need that extra $20 worth of assets? Had they given people sort of $500 or some other productive technology that didn't require the same complementarities in order to sort of start milking it for money? That was not an intended pun. would they have observed, like, something more like a linear progression up, right? But I'm not saying that is the case, but I'm just saying that there's something about the production function in farming and the lack of outside options that might also be playing a big role here. Like, that's, I want to be clear here, I don't think that means that the paper's, you know, not picking up something real or something important, because the fact is that in many places in the world, those are the options, and you either have the complementarity or you don't, right? But there's a philosophical, almost a conceptual difference there.
I mean, are you asking whether or not there would have been another type of transfer within this context, which would have had a different effect, or if the same transfer in a different context would have the same effect?
I think it's both, right? They actually acknowledge themselves, right, that at some point in the paper, they say that, what's the sentence? Is there something along the lines of, in village economies that were better functioning, which had higher earnings potential, the threshold above which you had to be was lower.
Right. Although there was still an S-shaped curve for those villages, though. So there's still, people were still getting stuck in poverty traps.
Right. Then again, remember that their sample is like 1,309 of the poorest villages in Bangladesh.
Right.
So what we're basically saying is that like there is something messed up in these markets that creates a poverty trap somewhere. I guess what I'm saying is that like two things. One is that the poverty trap exists because the markets are messed up. What follows from that is not necessarily that the solution is to bridge everybody over the poverty trap. It could also be that the solution is you need, you know, you want to make these
cow shares
economies. Yeah. Right. But you want to make these economies function better, right? Create the market for cow shares or create, you know, whatever. Build a road, make it easier for people to migrate out. What, I don't know, right? But my point is that, like, that's the other way that you might think about this. And then the second question is there another mode of production that you could introduce that doesn't require the same complementarity, right? Like, what if you, instead of giving people a $500 cow, you give people, I don't know, a $300 camera? Is there a market for being a portrait photographer in the village? That's a stupid example because, you know... These are really, really poor places. They don't have the market for it, whatever.
Or, you know, one laptop for every child in the village could be another option, you know?
Yeah. What? Like a bicycle. A bicycle so they can, you know, travel a bit further to a bigger market. I don't know, right?
Or I think is where you're going, you know, giving them a bus ticket to go to a city and where someone can earn a decent wage, perhaps.
I was exactly thinking of that DC bus tickets paper when I said that, actually, yeah?
So interesting point, you know... I think as economists, we always try and think of what the market failure is and how can we fix that market failure first rather than just getting people to step around it. But also figuring out the market failure and how to fix it, you know, one has to ask like, A, why hasn't someone figured out, can I keep saying cow shares until someone markets it, but even if it's not a viable thing. But either someone hasn't figured it out for a reason, probably because you can't make money off of it. And it would take time to figure out that market failure where... time and money, to be honest. And so if we figured out a way that's not cheap, but cheap versus like what the alternatives are to get people out of the trap, maybe it just makes sense just to push them out.
Yeah, no, I totally buy that. So I'm not, again, I say like, I'm not making the argument that this means that this undermines somehow like what this paper is trying to do, right? I am just saying that conceptually, it does mean that there is like Europe, if you are the government of Bangladesh, thinking about what do I learn from this paper for how I fix poverty in these really, really poor places, there is a real choice about what you do. The benefit of the paper is not just that it says, hey, you should roll this up to, you know, everybody in the village everywhere, everybody in every village everywhere. The benefit of the paper is that it illustrates what mechanism keep people in poverty and like what are the things that sort of correlate with how, like, you know, how bad that trap is, right? And that opens up for you many other ways of thinking about how do you fix it, right? And, you know, it's interesting that you said, actually, just now, that, like, it might take a really long time to fix this thing, because one of the papers that they compare their results with is another example where a paper sort of gave a transfer in 1 year and then came back, like, 10 years later and... had a look and see what the effects were, right? And it's the Blackman, Fiala, and Martinez paper. That paper, like, they give a bunch of, I think it's in Uganda, right? They give people a bunch of cash transfer, which allows them to create assets for their business.
Yeah, it's unconditional cash grants to young adults in northern Uganda.
Right, exactly. And it's a really cool paper, right? And in the first version of that paper, they find, you know, big effects. The people who get the grant have more business assets, better income, blah, blah, blah. They're doing really, really well. And then they go back a number of years later and they find, like, after 8 years that actually the control group have caught up, right? Mm. And that's actually kind of good news in a sense, right? It's good news in the sense that it means that they found a situation where, you know, actually people do catch up, albeit slowly, right? So they're saying that in this, I would need to have a look at the sort of PPP conversions or whatever, but my guess is quite substantially bigger and more diverse, richer and more diverse market that they're working in than the really, really poor bits of rural Bangladesh where there's like own a cow or don't own a cow, right? They find that it's, you know, that diversity, that extra sort of economic opportunity means that there is no trap, but there is a problem of time. It takes a really long time and it's unreliable whether or not you will be able to sort of, you know, increase your income. And when I was working at DFID, I wrote this paper up with a colleague of mine at the time. We were writing about what should this mean about how we think about cash transfers. Does it mean we stop doing cash transfers because they don't have long-term differences between the control and the treatment group after 8 years? And the conclusion we came to was like, obviously not, right? It's a totally non-negligible thing to move someone's timeline for a better life up by, you know, 6 or 7 years. That's 6 or 7 years of a better life multiplied over however many people get it, which is big. That's a huge human welfare gain.
Right. And I don't know, for the Blattman et al. Paper, I don't know what the outcomes were for the rest of the household, but presumably that's 8 years more of children being better fed and more years of schooling. There's all sorts of other things that can happen during that time.
Yeah.
But also doesn't mean that also highlights another interesting point, something the authors of this paper bring up, which is that if you'd taken that exact same transfer in northern Uganda and given it to these poor people in rural Bangladesh, at the same size of a transfer in terms of the percentage of household income, it would have been way more than enough to push these people out of a poverty trap. And so the actual where the poverty trap is in a given context, as in terms of how much of your kind of annual income is necessary to get over it, is going to differ from place to place, right? So just because a cash transfer program doesn't work in a location doesn't mean that it could never work. It just might not have been enough to get people over the hump.
Yeah, exactly. In a sense, what we're talking about here is we're making implicit statements about how messed up was the market in northern Uganda compared to how messed up was the market in rural Bangladesh, right? Because if their point was that in the less messed up markets, the level at which the trap occurred was lower, right? You can basically argue that if you unfuck the market sufficiently, the trap disappears, in which case you would probably have found in those villages, if there are any villages in the sample where there is no, like, the market's functioning well enough, there's enough diversity of employment opportunity to sort of invalidate the trap, you would find similar results, that the people who get the transfer do better faster, and then the other people can catch up. Which, again, would still be like, it would still mean that the program worked. It's just a question of exactly how cost-effective it is.
I think you've also come up with a possible new title for our podcast, which is Market Unfuckers. So let's circle back for a moment to, like, so we, you know, I think we're both pretty convinced that this paper identified a poverty trap and that in this context it exists and that it raises all these interesting questions. So one is, like, how do we think differently about policy in that context? But the other thing is, like, you know, we started the podcast off and the paper starts us off with as this question and tension between whether or not people are in poverty because of their own characteristics or because of their setting, more or less. And that setting can include, you know, whether or not they have a cow. Who would one try to convince with this new result? Like, what policymakers are there that are out there who believe that the poor are all poor because of their own doing or their own characteristics? And you know, and now they're finally seeing the light of day, and they now know it's all about large asset transfer programs.
Well, as a CGD employee, I remain steadily nonpartisan, so I'm not going to name names. But, yeah, you know what? Actually, like, joking aside, the power here is not so much in convincing, hey, you know what? They're not all just lazy and feckless. It's more in convincing them that, like, you need to do something big to solve the problem.
Go big or go home.
Yeah, and it makes, you know, this is always the thing that Jeff Sachs used to say about the MVPs, was that his argument was, if you don't invest all at once, you waste the money. You can't do it drip by drip.
Just for listeners who may not be fully aware of Jeffrey Sachs' Millennium Village project, but the idea was that there are kind of multifaceted poverty traps that people face in terms of agricultural markets, in terms of access to education and health, and that you have to provide, you know, basically public goods or publicly provided goods along all these dimensions, all in one big push at about, I think, was it like over $1,000 per person? I'm going to get the numbers wrong, but it was...
We should ask Michael. Michael will remember.
But so maybe Sachs and the crew weren't wrong about there being a poverty trap, but just wrong about its nature.
Well, yeah, but I mean, I think the biggest argument against the MVPs was never fundamentally, this is a really stupid idea. I think the biggest argument, though, the thing that, like, Michael and...
Gabriel de Mombinus.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah, Gabriel, right? The thing that they were always arguing was not simply, this is a dumb idea and we're going to prove that you're wrong.
You need to test it.
You need to test it. You need to make sure that you're using the money properly and that you're fixing the things that need to be fixed. Because there was so much money, that was always really important. And I guess what we wound up with was there was a rigorous external evaluation that found it didn't achieve much more than sort of project outputs, right? But there was never the sort of secondary bit of the analysis, which is what we always, like, which is what we ideally would have had, which was, is this fundamentally a problem with this big push analysis, or is this the wrong big push?
I want to transition a bit to, like, other types of poverty traps, and but I was just thinking the other day when I was looking at the paper. So let's just say, obviously, the poverty trap is going to differ across different contexts. Obviously, like, what is needed is going to differ. But let's imagine it really was $500 per person, and then they're free. I need to do the numbers again, but I think roughly if you just take all of Jeff Bezos's wealth and just distribute it to every poor person in the world, you get enough money, basically. Or maybe I think it's Jeff Bezos plus Bill Gates. So why not just, like, make these massive transfers and then call it a day? Or why not convince them to give it through, you know, effective philanthropy? Maybe not expropriate it, but... You know, I'm obviously saying this up as something to be argued against.
It's a good point. I'm just trying not to be too flippant in my answer, right? When we study poverty, we are looking at one section of a huge income distribution globally, right? Even within a country, right? The income distribution is broad. It goes from people who are on, like, 20 cents a day or 10 or zero, nothing a day, people who are dying quite quickly, to people who might be on, you know, like, as rich as getting, I don't know what a plausible number is, $100 a day, who knows, right, a lot. It's a very, very big income distribution. And all of the sort of experimental studies that we see, they can only ever look at a tiny slice of that, really. So this is huge income distribution, and we're only ever really studying a pretty small slice of it. We're only looking at people who start off at around, you know, $1.50 a day or $1 a day. And then pretty much, like, even if we study them for 10 years, they're probably earning $2.50 a day, $3.50 a day, something like that, right? I mean, I don't know what the numbers are, but it's not going to be a big chunk of that income distribution. Now, my guess is that this sort of curve of income is not... It does not have one kink in it.
This is not the only poverty trap you can fall into.
It's not the only trap, right? Lan Pritchett used to say no one threw a party because they got it to $1.90. It's true. No one throws a party when they get to $3 a day either, right? There's this cool paper from ages ago by Banerjee and Duflo, which looks at, I think the paper is called What is Middle Class About the Middle Classes Around the World? And it's a really nice, interesting paper because it documents that at characteristics that we call middle class kick in at different levels of income according to the characteristic, and some kick in well before you escape poverty in some cases. I think I'm not mischaracterizing that, maybe I am. The point is, anyway, that there's no victory in, you know, when SDG 1 gets achieved, finally, if it ever does, I'm not going to suddenly think, well, job done, and stop thinking about development, right? You know, there's still a lot of misery in the world.
Yeah.
Maybe we can get a one-off and improve everybody by seizing Bill Gates' wealth, but I'm not confident enough in the dynamic effects of that, nor am I confident enough in the disincentive effects that might have on future sort of potential Bill Gates' to suggest it as a policy, right? I'm also not saying that it's obviously stupid, right? It's not obviously stupid. It's possibly a bit heartless to Bill Gates, but...
But I think I think it's always worth keeping in the back of our minds, what's the cost of just moving everyone out of extreme poverty, and as kind of a, not as like an actual policy that we should necessarily pursue, but more as the kind of benchmark for how we think about other policies that, you know, we think that policy can do better than this in the long run, if not immediately. But it's worth checking that we can do better than just giving everyone money right now and moving them across the at least the ultra poor line, if not the poverty line.
I have sympathy for people who implement and try programs that in the short term or in the frame of the intervention do not do as much as a simple cash transfer in terms of sort of income consumption, right? But maybe achieve some sort of benefit that can be passed down intergenerationally, like, or, you know, raise the ceiling higher than for income generation possibility than they lift the floor, right? I have sympathy for that. But I also think that too many donors do too much stuff which did not pass the benchmark for is it better than cash short or long term. I don't think that would actually lead to like a 60% reallocation of, say, FCDO's portfolio. I think it would be a much smaller reallocation than that, a very, very much smaller reallocation than that, but that would be a reallocation. So yeah, I totally buy that that's a useful thought experiment.
What's the FCPDO for listeners outside of the UK?
Oh yeah, sorry. It's a Foreign Commonwealth and Development Office in the UK. What used to be DFID, sorry. The other thing about development is lousy with jargon.
So before we wrap up, just one more thought about the benefits of getting people out of these poverty traps. At some point in the paper, the authors calculate how much money people could be earning. They have this model where they basically try to figure out what's the optimal, where should you be optimally allocating your efforts in making money in rural Bangladesh. And their conclusion is cows, right? Like cows and cattle and that kind of work. And they find that basically the total for this group of people that they're looking at, before they get the transfer, the total amount of money that's being left on the table, money they could be earning if they just had the assets they needed to work with, is about $15 million. But the actual amount of the program, the cost of the program, is only $1 million. And so the program pays for itself not only, you know, with the very reasonable goal of getting people out of extreme poverty, but it also just makes financial sense. These are people that are waiting. They are all Eddie Murphy's waiting to be on the stock trading floor. They just need to be given the opportunity to get out there and make money.
I mean, it comes back to what we were saying about market failures in a sense, right? Presumably, there is money to be made by giving people these assets, and somebody's not making that money.
Right, but it might be hard to write contracts to get them, you know, to get the returns back or
it's always, you know, hard to write contracts. It's always hard to write contracts. Hang on a sec. Read this.
I can see the moral economy. Is this Michael Sandel?
No, it's Sam Bowles, right? It's always hard to write contracts. And one of the things that I do a lecture at BSG with Stefan on public procurement, and one of the points that we really make is that all complex contracts are incomplete. That's something Oliver Williams had said. But pretty much all contracts are complex too. You don't need to have a complete contract to make a market work. There are many other things that you can also use. There are moral kind of, like the thing I love about that book, The Moral Economy, is that a lot of it is about what beyond the market makes the market work. Yeah, it's hard to write a good contract for a cow or for, you know, lending to get a cow in rural Bangladesh. But it's insurmountably difficult. You know, if I believed enough in this paper and I believed enough in that maths and I was a more entrepreneurial person, maybe I would actually be starting to think about, you know, like, how could I fill this gap and make money out of filling it?
And yet, I think the sign that neither of us is really, our destinies are that intertwined with the private sector is the fact that we both worked for the public or nonprofit sector pretty much our entire lives, which might say something about our ability to be the next startup founders.
Well, yes, quite. Yeah. I would not invest in me, so, you know, and doing anything other than writing papers and giving podcasts. So
this episode was brought to you by our midlife crisis. Okay, this has been really great, Randall. Let's wrap up the discussion of the poverty traps paper, and maybe we can each give one last thought about the paper before we move on to another discussion.
Right, when this paper came out and I first read it, I think the primary attraction to most people, and I still think the primary attraction to most people, was that, wow, okay, here's this really beautiful empirical depiction of something that we've thought about in theory, and that our theory predicts will look a very specific way, and hey, look, we found it in the wild. And I think that's still a huge thing that this paper does, that is not trivial, it's enormous, it's basically saying that this theoretical concept that's been guiding some of how we think about poverty, it looks real. But the biggest takeaway I would take from this paper is something slightly different, actually. It's that this theoretical concept does exist in the wild, but like a lot of other wild creatures, it will probably look slightly different and behave slightly differently in different habitats. And I think that the conceptual power of the paper, or rather, the paper should have a bigger influence on the way we conceptually think about poverty in different contexts than it should have on, say, the empirical question of at what point does a poverty trap exist? At what dollar figure? You know, how much of a transfer do I need to get you over that poverty trap? Instead, I think it should subtly sometimes reframe the way we design interventions and development. That's my big takeaway here.
That's really insightful. I might think my takeaway is fairly basic, and that is, you know, we sometimes frame, you know, there are multiple objectives in kind of in development policy, and one of them, Owen Barter used to say this a lot, that one of them is just maintaining a certain level of welfare for people. Just we don't like it when people are poor. We want to make sure they live lives with dignity and with, you know, with a certain level of wealth and happiness and et cetera. And we also have a grander development objective. We want to see economies grow. We want to see people move out of poverty. So, you know, there's sometimes this objective of just maintaining a certain level of a sustenance for people and one of just actively getting, you know, countries to become richer. And this paper doesn't speak to, you know, anything really macro related, but at least suggests for, you know, maybe just this particular context, that those two objectives aren't fully in tension, that you have a transfer that, you know, I'm not sure if the asset transfer, the way it's valued in the papers in PPP terms, but you have a transfer that will probably push most of these people, if you did it on a yearly basis, out of poverty just through the transfer itself. And so it meets kind of a very basic sustenance objective. And you could do it every year and also know you get this extra benefit of like pushing people out of the poverty trap and getting them on a new trajectory. So that's just kind of what came to my mind, at least while I was reading the paper.
That's a really nice way of framing it. That's a really nice way of summarizing it. But that was a lot of fun, actually. It's been a really long time. I mean, when we lived in the same country, we used to do this sort of thing all the time. We would sit down over a meal or a bottle of wine. And, you know, it wouldn't necessarily be so structured over a single paper, but we had these kind of conversations all the time.
Yeah, and they only occasionally involve shouting.
Yeah, there'd be a lot more there'd be a lot more profanity, many, many more movie references, and we wouldn't be so worried about copyright infringement. But yeah, one of the worst things about the pandemic has been that method of learning, that discursive method of learning among friends, has really been curtailed. Half of what I learned from my colleagues when I was at DFID was not because we were formally working on something, but because we went and had a coffee and started talking about things that were on our mind or that we were working on. Do you remember? Like, we used to have these knockdown, drag-out arguments about sort of basic ideas in economics. Like, I think at one point you almost stormed out of dinner in Tanzania in Dar es Salaam because I disagreed with you about something and I can't even remember what it was anymore.
It was about whether or not econometrics had methodological individualism embedded into it.
I would come around now, but I think actually a lot of movements beyond methodological individualism have been relatively recent since that conversation, so I don't think I was right. But anyway, like, my point is, like, I used to learn so much because you had such a different view of all of this to me. And for the last year and a bit, I've become a much better anthropologist because my wife is an anthropologist. but I haven't learned the same amount about economics.
Maybe we could just talk about one other thing from this week that we thought was interesting very briefly. And the only thing I would bring up is in this week's issue of The Economist, they chose their country of the year. And I don't know if you saw, but the country of the year was Malawi.
Really? Oh, yeah, because, I mean, it had the most hopeful election of the year, right?
Malawi was the only country that apparently moved up in the, you know, the standard metrics of democracy and peace in the world this year. While the rest of the world was burning, Malawi had, you know, for those that don't know the country well, its president, Peter Mutharika, who was the successor to his own brother a few years before, Mutharika had won.
With an interregnum, right?
Right. It had not been governing the country that well. And then after 4 years, tried to steal the election a second time around. And the courts, there were protests, and the courts ruled the election was not up to scrap, and there was a rerun, and Lazarus Chakwera won. And so it was the first time in recent memory that, at least in Malawi, the courts have sided with democracy and made the right choice.
So I remember when we worked in Malawi, it was this really sort of, when I was, most of the time I was there, it was this very dysfunctional time, because everybody who lived in Malawi at this time will remember this Section 65. And Section 65 meant that it was ambiguous constitutionally whether crossing the floor in Parliament was legal. And that was interesting because the president crossed the floor in Parliament. He created his own party after being elected on another party's ticket. If I recall correctly, what it meant was that there was this perpetual threat of deadlock in Parliament, that any time he wanted to do something that couldn't garner cross-party support, there would be the threat to hijack the debate to discuss Section 65, which could draw the curtain on his presidency. And if I remember, like, my recollection of that period, it was when Malawi's governance was at its best in the sort of decade that I sort of followed it, mainly because of exactly that threat. There was no option of just doing what they wanted. It was a real sort of advert for the importance of contestability, even in democracies. You know, genuine contestability. As soon as he won his second election in a landslide, everything started to fall apart. That coincided with me leaving the country. So I've always wondered, you know, was it the election or was it my departure? You know, we cannot experimentally untangle that. But yeah, it was really nice actually to follow on social media from our old colleagues and our old friends. There was a lot of hope. I remember after the Arab Spring, writing a series of pieces which were about, like, is this hope justified? You read the papers today and there's a lot of people who say no.
The article in The Economist put it nicely in that it pointed out that, like, Malawi still has a gazillion problems. It's still a very poor country. But at least in this instance, that its people proved that they were citizens, not subjects, by pushing for another election. So even if the new president doesn't turn out to be that effective, at least they had that one win.
So, you know, Malawi doesn't have a central square, right? Where Lilongwe doesn't have a central square, right?
Right.
And the presidential compound is down at the end of that really, really long straight road, right?
It's a bad sign typically when the president chooses to put his or her accommodation really, really far away from where anyone can get near it.
Yeah, and the whole of Lilongwe is actually structured so that the different sort of densely populated poor bits are sort of separated by large swathes of land and other settlements in between. So it's really not a trivial achievement to have protested sufficiently.
I think what you're suggesting, Randall, is we should write a paper which looks at the distance between, you know, the president or prime minister's house and the most of the population of the nearest city as an instrument for democracy.
And how straight the road is. If the road is really straight, it means that you can see people coming from really far away. If the road's all curvy and everything, then you don't really know.
With that, we should wrap up the end of this podcast. Thank you, everyone, for joining us for this inaugural episode.
Thank you, everybody. Yeah, that was really fun. Fun for us, at least.
Stay tuned. In a month, we're going to be looking at a paper on the impact of nudges. And so thank you. Thank you for listening to Paper Round.
Yeah, the podcast which starts with S-shaped curves and ends with S-shaped roads. And then that could be the end, right?